when you're looking at a $3 billion deficit, you have to take into consideration that we're not going to be able to do all of the things that we did before.
The tough job of reining in state spending. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congressman Young has an idea for funding a border wall. Sell bonds.
But then the decision will be up to you, the American people, whether you want to build a wall or not. It won't work.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
The House Finance Committee has proposed cutting $31 million from the state budget. That's a little less than 1% of the amount the legislature directly controls. As the full House considers the spending plan next week, clear differences have emerged over whether those cuts are deep enough. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on the debate.
The budget is similar to the one proposed by Governor Bill Walker. Most of the changes that the House Finance Committee made were to areas outside of the agencies that provide government services. For example, the committee's proposal includes a $37 million cut to oil and gas tax credits. Committee co-chairman Paul Seaton notes that the legislature has already cut hundreds of millions of dollars from state agencies over the last few years. Seaton is a majority caucus Republican from Homer.
When you go in and try to nickel and dime agencies and pull threads out of the fabric, all of a sudden you just make it so the agency can't work to deliver the service that people want.
The Department of Transportation would see the largest cut. Education and early development would see the largest increase. Finance Committee member Kathy Tilton, a Republican from Wasilla, says the cuts don't go far enough at a time when residents are looking at cuts to their permanent fund dividends.
What I'm hearing from my constituents is they wanted to see some true reductions in agency operations, and there was none of that.
Tilton also says the committee shouldn't have increased funds to areas like the Alaska Marine Highway.
There are a lot of things that we wish that we could do. When you have dollars in your budget and in your home budget, you're able to do more things. But when you're looking at a $3 billion deficit, you have to take into consideration that we're not going to be able to do all of the things that we did before.
The Finance Committee minority proposed about $150 million in cuts to individual line items, plus another $75 million in cuts to the amount schools receive based on the number of students who attend. But Seaton notes that the minority would actually have increased the budget. That's because it wanted to reverse Governor Bill Walker's veto of half of the permanent fund dividends paid out last fall. Some of the biggest differences are over how to handle the permanent fund. The Finance Committee majority proposes drawing more than $4 billion from permanent fund earnings this year to fund the budget.
We've passed a fully funded budget for 2018, and out of the House Finance Committee, I anticipate that being fully funded as it leaves the floor.
The full House is scheduled to debate amendments to the budget on Monday. Senate majority members say they want to cut roughly $300 million from the budget. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Alaska Congressman Don Young doesn't like President Trump's plan to build a wall on the border with Mexico, and his objection isn't on humanitarian grounds. Young said at a public forum in Washington this week that the wall just won't work.
Well, I'm not going to spend $18, $20, $100 billion to build something that's not going to work.
The event, recorded by Young's staff, was a roundtable on ocean policy. Young said he doesn't like the budget cuts for the Coast Guard and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that Trump reportedly wants. Young segued from there into a discussion of the wall. The congressman told the forum he had a better idea for funding it.
I want to sell wall bonds. Think about this a moment. It's a playoff of war bonds.
Young says it'd be like the bonds the U.S. sold to finance World War II. He suggests the government could offer 2.5% interest.
But then the decision will be up to you, the American people, whether you want to build a wall or not. They won't work. That's up to you, because you get a return on your money.
Young spokesman Matt Shukaro noted the Alaska congressman voted against an enhanced border fence a decade ago. Young said at the time it would be ineffective at stopping illegal traffic. A judge in Alaska has dealt a legal blow to opponents of the Inupiaq name approved by voters for the nation's northernmost town. Superior Court Judge Paul Rotman on Friday denied a request to halt implementation of the transition from the old name of Barrow to Utqiagvik until a lawsuit filed by the local Alaska Native Corporation is resolved. Name change opponents argued the city broke its own laws by failing to publish a public notice before the remaining question was put on the local ballot in October. Rotman says the opponents failed to show that continuing the transition process would harm them or that they would probably succeed in making their case. He set a hearing on the civil lawsuit for March 22nd. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a wild salmon's trip from a net to a Sitka student's plate.
No one that's not vegetarian does not like fish that I know.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Autism Resource Center presents Autism Insights, featuring a dynamic young woman with autism, Dani Bowman, who's a national speaker, advocate, and entrepreneur. Join Dani in Fairbanks Sunday, March 12th, in Valdez on Tuesday, March 14th, in Palmer on Thursday, March 16th, and in Sitka on Saturday, March 18th. Free and open to the public. More at alaskaarc.org. This message sponsored by AARC.
A dog has died in this year's Iditarod. According to Iditarod officials, it happened shortly before midnight just outside the Galena checkpoint. The dog, a two-year-old named Deacon, was part of race veteran Seth Barnes' team. Upon arriving at the checkpoint, vets tried to resuscitate the animal, but to no avail. A necropsy will be performed to determine the cause of death. Barnes first ran the race in 2015. The first three mushers to arrive in Huslia all had 16 dogs on the line, the same number they started the race with nearly 500 miles ago. Up and down the leaderboard, mushers are arriving with big teams. Early in the race, there was concerns about recent snows obscuring long segments of the trail. But Linwood Fiddler says between the formidable cold weather and work of trail breakers, it's turned out to be ideal terrain for running dogs.
It's been like a sprint track. I mean, except for a couple areas where it was slow getting into Ruby. I mean, it's great.
As the race speeds up along the coast, some mushers drop dogs to reduce the number of dogs they have to care for. As Jeff King points out, having more dogs on the line doesn't necessarily make a musher more competitive.
I wouldn't lose too much sleep about number of dogs. A few years ago, Boozer dropped 6 in Nikolai and went on with the next those 10 and finished 2nd.
Currently, the smallest teams still have 11 dogs. Huslia is hosting the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race for the second time ever. The interior village is rich in mushing history, as it is the home of the late sprint champion musher George Atla Jr. and other top names in Alaska dog racing. And as elite teams pass through the home of mushing royalty, KNOM's Ben Matheson reports, local dog drivers are looking ahead to the next generation of mushers.
77-year-old Wilson Sam has 20 dogs in his kennel overlooking the Koyukuk River.
We keep them back there, kind of close to the house where we can keep an eye on them.
Sam has been working with dogs all of his life, including hauling blocks of ice from frozen lakes before snow machines arrived in the 1960s. But he's a racer too. His living room is covered with trophies from dog races across Alaska. He's also run the 1,000-mile Yukon Quest. Sam says he's too old to mush dogs now, but he still trains the dogs with an ATV and snow machine. On the runners are his grandkids, like 22-year-old Kevin Elbert, who calls himself a rookie.
I raced 4 dogs, but that ain't nothing compared to 8 and 12, something like that.
He does, however, have his grandpa's 7 decades of experience to learn from, and when he was younger, he helped out with George Atla Jr.'s dogs. Every day, he comes over to do chores in the yard and train dogs. He's dreaming big for the backyard kennel in his first year.
I wouldn't mind racing the North American. That would be pretty fun to get into. I haven't got the dogs to do it yet. Got to wait a few years, my grandpa said.
That is the Open North American Championship, one of the top sprint races. As the Iditarod passes through town, Albert gains important insights and tips from pro mushers. He stayed up all night in 2015 when the race came through and helped out at the checkpoint. As Albert walks around Hooslea's main street where the mushers park their teams, he's here to soak up knowledge.
I was going to see what kind of water they give them, because some of my dogs don't even drink all the water. They like dump it sometimes. And ask them if they give them just straight water or chicken water or something.
The intergenerational knowledge has kept dog driving alive in Hooslea, but a region-wide program known as HL is helping to give young mushers a boost. It builds off the Frank Atla Youth Program founded by George Atla Jr. This is done in collaboration with the Gateway and Yukon-Koyukuk school districts. Floyd Vent Jr., the son of longtime musher Floyd Vent Sr., is racing for the first year. He says the program has helped him build a solid foundation to launch his bigger race ambitions.
So they've been giving us dog food, hay, and they help us out a lot. So it's looking good in the future. We want to get into North American sometime in the future, so just got to keep pushing.
Vent ran the local New Year's race and traveled up to Hughes last weekend, missing out on first place by 2 seconds in a 16-mile race. Hugh Beifelt has the only kennel in Hughes, and he's beginning to bring in youth to work with the team.
We got to keep this thing going, y'all. And to start with these kids, you know, it's a dream of the late George Atla to keep the sport going. And we're going to work with the youth, teach, you know, our knowledge, pass our knowledge on to them so we can keep it going.
And as this year's Iditarod moves towards Koyukuk, the next batch of local mushers will stay behind, training their dogs to make dreams reality. For KNOM News, I'm Ben Matheson in Hooslea.
The native village of Napaimute is starting a commercial lumber business in the Middle Kuskokwim this year. The workers are currently moving the sawmill 40 miles downriver from Chuathbalak to 3 miles below Kalskag, where KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports the mill will create commercial lumber on demand, creating jobs and providing cheaper, locally sourced lumber for Kuskokwim residents.
We have a good crew. They look like they don't need me right now. I just like to talk a little bit.
Mark Leary has been trucking milling equipment and buildings down the frozen Kuskokwim for weeks with the Napaimute crew. He's the director of development and operations for the native village. And when we talked, their truck had just broken down again.
We are 6 miles below Aniak in the middle of the river working. We'll get it fixed. This is everyday stuff for us, breaking down on the river.
Leary says they could have waited for summer and chartered a barge to transport everything, but who would that help, he asked.
Very few local people working in the barge industry anymore, and we chose to move it ourselves by ice road so our guys can get to work.
By the way, those ice roads, the Kuskokwim Highway, the same crew also plowed those, 250 miles of smoothed ice connecting the Kuskokwim villages. The ice road, the sawmill, Leary says, it's all about creating jobs.
You ask any young person in our region what they want. They want a job. They want a job. And as I have so many people calling, asking, you got any openings? You got any openings? So many guys looking for work.
So how many people will this put to work?
We'll see. We might be 10, 12 people. And since all this is located near Kalskag, they all come from Kalskag. And that's a huge impact on a community to have that many people working.
3 miles below Kalskag is where the sawmill will sit. It'll be on the same 400 acres of white spruce that Napaimute harvests and operates as a firewood business. Napaimute leases the land from the Kuskokwim Corporation. Andrea Gusty with TKC says they're negotiating a new agreement that includes the sawmill.
Napaimute has been an excellent steward of the land. We had safeguards in place, environmental safeguards, reforestation requirements, and Napaimute has followed all of those.
Both parties expect to sign the new agreement soon. Napaimute bought the sawmill from the Nelson family in Chuathbalak, who hadn't regularly used the mill for about a decade. The village received a $600,000 federal grant to fund the move. Besides jobs, Mark Leary says the business will also provide cheaper, locally sourced lumber for the Kuskokwim. The demand, he says, is already here.
In the past couple of weeks, I've probably had 6 different families call me wanting to purchase house packages because they have tax return money right now.
Leary says a 16 by 24 foot cabin package will sell for about $8,000. The crew should finish moving the equipment this week. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Wednesday was International Women's Day. Some women in the U.S. stayed home from work to highlight the economic importance of women. Others wore red in a show of solidarity or committed to not shopping for the day or only shopping at women-owned businesses. Hillary Morgan is the executive director of the YWCA in Anchorage. She says her staff struggled with how to show support but also honor women who do not have the option of missing a day of work. In Alaska, where domestic violence and sexual assault rates are perennially high, and the rate of pay for women ranks 48th in the nation. Morgan says they kept the office open to offer support for those who need it. She says low pay for women often means being stuck.
If you have $100,000 in the bank, your decisions are much different than if you have nothing. And so the economic independence for women, I think, is a critical issue. And I also think that it then empowers women to be able to make decisions about what they will put up with and what they won't put up with. The other piece of this that I feel very strongly about is that I think we need to stop looking at these issues as women's issues, because they're not.
You mentioned the pay initiative that the YWCA of Alaska has undertaken, looking for equality in pay for women. Where is your initiative now? What's happening with it, and what do the next 6 months to a year look like?
Mm-hmm. So we're at the end of the second year, beginning our third year. The first year was really spent seeing if there was a community concern about this issue broader than just the YWCA. And we did that through going to many, many companies and individuals and politicians to see if that they would endorse the initiative. You know, we were hoping to get maybe between 20 and 30 in the first year, and we now have 112. And we've only had 5 people decline to sign it, all of them Alaska state legislators. And so what that tells us is that this is actually an issue that is of great concern to all Alaskans.
You mentioned that overall you've had great response. There's been a handful of folks, lawmakers and businesses, who have at this point declined to participate. What's the reticence? What have they said gives them pause to not sign on?
There are actually still people that just don't believe that there is a gap.
They don't believe that women get paid less?
Yes. Yes. So, and all of our information we're getting from our own Department of Labor, the Alaska Department of Labor, and the American Cities Survey, which is a survey used to compare the largest cities in all 50 states. So we're using data that has been validated from lots of smarter people than us.
Hillary Morgan is the executive director of YWCA of Alaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron.
This week on AK, fish to school. Plenty of Alaskan grown-ups love their salmon, but what about our kids? If you live in Sitka, the answer is a lot. KCAW's Emily Russell reports on how a wild salmon makes its way out of the net and onto a student's plate.
It's a little after 11 in the morning at Keet Gushaheen Elementary School in Sitka. The cafeteria is quiet. That is, until the doors open and students flood in.
All right. Be nice, kind, and courteous, all right?
When she's got her food, I sit down with a second grader named Lorelei.
Lorelei?
Uh-huh.
How do you spell that?
L-O-R-E-L-A-I.
She's sitting next to her friend who's pecking at a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Lorelei's lunch, though, it looks a little different.
And, can you tell me what's on your tray right now?
Salmon, chocolate, milk, and vegetables.
That's right, salmon.
The fish lunch is served every Wednesday in all the schools in the district, as well as at Mount Edgecombe High School.
Lexi Hackett has been with the Fish to Schools lunch program from the start. She says the idea came out of Sitka's annual health summit back in 2009.
And the priority that was chosen was getting locally caught fish in the school lunch programs in Sitka.
Hackett grew up in a fishing family in Sitka. She runs her own boat with her husband now, and she's on track to become a registered dietitian. She actually just finished her master's in nutrition.
So fatty fish, like salmon, black cod, for example, two local favorites, are really high in omega-3 fatty acids, which are anti-inflammatory.
Hackett says those omega-3 fatty acids, they encourage brain development, especially in kids and young adults.
That's definitely very relevant to serving fish in our schools.
It's, you know, well received by the kids. They love fish, and they know it's good for them.
David Glazier is a retired music teacher turned commercial fisherman. He's been donating to the program since the beginning.
Well, I feel like I owe the schools a lot for my career.
Glazier is referring to the retirement package he got from the Sitka School District. But Eunice Ferusen says, really, it's just the right thing to do.
Us fishermen are good-hearted people.
This is Ferusen's second year donating to Fish to Schools. Sitka Conservation Society, a partner in the program, organizes the annual coho drive every August. That makes it easy for local fishermen to help out.
Basically, yeah. I was just asked during the offload if I would. And, well, it's a good thing to do, you know.
More than 30 fishermen donated to the program this year. That's just enough to cover about a quarter of the 2,000 pounds of salmon needed to make it a weekly lunch. The rest, it's purchased by the Sitka School District through funding from a state grant aimed at getting locally grown foods into schools.
I don't know how to explain it, but kids in Sitka like fish.
Cassie Olin is the business manager for the Sitka School District.
I wear many hats within the district.
One of those is the food services director hat. With that on, Olin oversees the weekly logistics of fish to schools. It all starts the day before. The fish are brought up from the cold storage to thaw out at the high school. That's also where the processing and portioning happens.
Chef Joe, the head chef up at the high school, and her helper, they pull all the pin bones out of all of it. That takes a couple hours to do.
On the day of, the fish are seasoned, cooked, loaded into warm boxes, and sent out to other schools.
All that happens between breakfast, which usually ends about 8:39, and like here at Keet, they're serving lunch right now at 11:20.
About half the kids in the cafeteria have a salmon fillet on their trays today.
No one that's not vegetarian does not like fish that I know.
So you're saying everybody likes
that? That I know. It's not vegetarian.
That's Saren. She's in fifth grade. She takes a second to think of her favorite foods of all time.
Salmon is second on my list of favorite foods.
That is, of course, behind caramel chocolates, Saren tells me. When I ask her what it would be like if there was no Fish to Schools lunch program, her eyes get really wide.
The zombie apocalypse. I'm kidding. But there would be like an apocalypse kind of thing.
There's enough grant money to fund the program through next year. After that, though, it's up to the district's food service budget and the donation drive to prevent the Alaskan-style apocalypse of an empty freezer. For AK, I'm Emily Russell.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Carlos Tayag in Unalaska. Tayag is the teen and leisure program coordinator for the city and moved to the island from Washington 3 years ago.
I'm the most likely to do anything fun on the island when it comes to leisure activities after school. So if a kid comes to me with some crazy idea like, hey, we should go hike that hill, or We should play Dungeons and Dragons, or we should go play soccer outside because it's a really nice day, or we should just go over there and build snowmen and tackle them. We will probably do that. There's probably a time every day where a person or a kid comes up to me and asks me if I would like to play soccer, and the answer is always yes. And that's probably one of my most favorite things about working in that building, is the ability to play pickup soccer anytime, any day. Soccer is becoming a sport here. I think we've done a lot of work in the last 3 years to bring soccer to the community. In 3 years, I think we've drastically improved the way that we play soccer on the island, because 3/4 of the year we're still playing indoors. So we've kind of adapted our indoor soccer to the US standards for indoor soccer. And we also get to play outside in the summer, and it's really fun and nice. And I think interest has grown exponentially. Like, there's a ton of kids who now want to play soccer, and I think it's becoming more popular than basketball, which is really exciting for me, because basketball, when I got here, they told me basketball is king on the island. And so I thought, we can change that. We're working on putting together a soccer club that can travel throughout the state of Alaska, and our kids can start playing on a statewide level and hopefully on a national level. And one day we'll get a kid from Unalaska to play in a World Cup, a real World Cup.
Carlos Tayag lives in Unalaska. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Russell and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Ben Matheson and Zachariah Hughes in Hooslia, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
The North Slope Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Utqiagvik March 15th and 16th at the Inupiat Heritage Center from 9 to 5. To develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years, and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.